Blog Talk Radio.
Special guest is Larry Dorman from the ASME Union. And
here at Council for in New Britain, Connecticut.
He's the Public Affairs Coordinator for ASME, and he will be joining us and filling us in on the union events and what's going on around the country and
state of Connecticut.
And around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully we'll talk a bit about the Obama Jobs Plan and a couple other.
What his take is on that.
Yeah. So, and we're going to go right now.
And we also have our regular guest on at 9 o'clock with In the Ring with Woody.
Yep.
And he'll be on. And between our guest and our regular guest, we have some news.
Yes.
For you.
Yes, we do. And, we're kind of going to concentrate a little bit more on health and stuff, but today I've got a lot of interesting stuff. But, for instance, how Taco Bell and KFC, federal government to subsidize fast food through food stamps. Isn't that something? It's going to allow you to eat at McDonald's on your food stamps. And
I don't like that idea for people.
No, I don't either. And U.S. is collapsing, the ex-Treasury Secretary. Let's start with that one right now.
Oh, that's uplifting.
It's not a very long article, but it's kind of like not too bad. I give you a boost tonight about the future of the U.S.
U.S.
economy.
Is collapsing, ex-Treasury Secretary. Yeah. A former U.S. Treasury Secretary says the United States is collapsing.
Like Larry Summers, by the way.
Due to major economic crises and needs long-term economic plans to recover. In an article written for Newsweek, Lawrence Summers commented on U.S. President Barack Obama's short-term plan saying, "We need not a one-year, but a 10-year commitment to rebuilding the country." Summers, who is Treasury Secretary under Bill Clinton, said the United States is underperforming, millions are out of work, and tens of millions have depressed incomes. Referring to Obama's recent address to Congress on job creation, he added, "Obama was clear about what everyone, from storekeepers to economists, from corporate CEOs to unemployed workers, knows, until there is more demand for their products, firms will not hire more workers." Summers said Obama was right to focus on creating the demand, noting that to create demand, the country's crumbling infrastructure should be rebuilt. "If a moment when the government can borrow for 10 years at less than 2%, when unemployment among construction workers is well into double digits, is not the moment for the infrastructure investment, it's hard to imagine when that time will come," he argued. He's got a good point there.
He warned that the economic situation will continue to deteriorate if government does not do its part in pushing the economy forward, nor just this year, but for years to come.
Lawrence Henry Summers served as the 71st U.S. Treasury Secretary from 1999 to 2001 under Bill Clinton. He was the 27th president of Harvard University from 2001 to 2006. Summers also directed the U.S. National Economic Council for Barack Obama until November 2010.
He said it was no end in sight,
Yeah.
You know, so it's like...
That was, by the way, from Press TV.
Yeah. So anyway.
Oh, here's one. Taco Bell, KFC lobby... Let's see what this says.
Fascinating, this one. This
is from Natural News. I don't know how people are going to feel about this.
This is going to grab you.
Taco Bell, KFC lobby, federal government to subsidize fast food through food stamps. And this is by a staff writer. Soviet-style government food distribution is quickly becoming standard practice in the rapidly decaying United States of America, with more than 20% of Americans now participating in the U.S. Department of Agriculture Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, also known as food stamps. And if the fast food industry gets its way, food stamps may soon cover buckets of fried chicken at KFC and Maximelt at Taco Bell. Food stamp benefits have more than doubled within the past 6 years, skyrocketing from $28.5 billion in 2005 to $64.7 billion in 2010. With this rise came the addition of 50,000 newly eligible businesses as well, which included convenience stores, dollar discount stores, even gas stations. And now the fast food industry wants a piece of the pie, too. According to a recent report in USA Today, Louisville, Kentucky-based Yum Brands, which owns Taco Bell, KFC, Long John Silver Restaurant, and Pizza Hut, is lobbying the federal government to permit SNAP enrollees to use food stamps at their restaurants, and they claim in doing so will help prevent hunger. But many in opposition are decrying the proposition as ridiculous in a blatant misuse of public funds in support of junk foods rather than health foods. It's preposterous that a company like Yum Brands would even be considered for inclusion in a program meant for supplemental nutrition, said Kelly Brownell, director of Yale University's Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity.
If the federal government ends up granting the fast food industry inclusion in the food stamp program, it will essentially be funneling taxpayer money into a system that promotes both abuse of the system and ill health. After all, fast food is laden with toxic chemicals and genetically modified organisms and contains little or no nutritional value.
So let's hope they don't allow it.
If participation in the food stamp program continues to rise, which is expected, based on the continual plummeting economy, the end result will essentially be a government-run system of fast food distribution in which most Americans have no choice but to eat the garbage peddled by their local fast food joints. So, man, I tell you, this is like, this gets crazier and freaking crazier. No?
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Here's a little video. I'm not sure.
This is from Natural News TV.
Rossum Foods raid. They took the cash.
Let's see what this says. The federal government has been raiding places.
Rossum Food raid. They took the cash. Rossum raid. Courtesy of Real Food Raid.
So we're going to see what's left over in there, and we'll let you guys know. It seems as though they took everything. So we'll let you know if there is something left and get back to you.
People walking through this raw food trying to see what
How many pages are in the first one?
They didn't take all the shit out of the refrigerator. Let's drink some milk.
What's the charge?
The charge is, it's a 187A, which is the conspiracy to commit a crime.
What's the crime?
It says, it was used, there's probable cause to believe that the property or the persons described herein may be found at the locations herein lawfully feasible pursuit of penalty code 1524.
That's crappy shit. All they were doing was they were just selling food.
Yeah, probably not GMO, probably not GMO.
Yeah, all raw foods,
Natural foods.
Oh, man. Oh, you get sick, folks. Here we go.
They took all their money. They took all their food.
Unbelievable.
If that's a video, you have to. It's really more visual than audio. You need to go on to naturalnews.com, and you can really see it for yourself. It can be quite upsetting.
There's another one here that I thought might be interesting. Ginger is an amazing wide-spectrum tonic and remedy. Check out the benefits of ginger?
Sure.
Why not? Natural root, ginger root, is more than a zesty culinary spice. It's both a general tonic and specific medicinal herb. And ginger is actually the rhizome or horizontal creeping root of the Zingerber officinal plant, which belongs to the same family as turmeric and cardamom. Chinese and Ayurvedic medicine has used ginger for centuries. Mainstream medicine uses various ginger extracts for major health problems. Ginger has been used effectively for gastrointestinal problems as major as colitis and as minor as motion sickness. It stimulates good digestion. It helps alleviate congestion.
Constipation.
Congestion. And minimizes mucus, even helping asthmatics. Various ginger extracts have been shown to improve cardiovascular health and circulation. And ginger kills off 5 LOIs enzymes, without which prostate cancer cells die within hours. As component of ginger has demonstrated the ability to slow or stop several types of cancers, metastasis, spreading cancer cells. Some oncologists use ginger extracts as adjuncts to their toxic therapies, enabling them to shorten the length of their patients suffering from chemo to radiation. It is also an excellent natural anti-inflammatory, more naturopaths and even MDs are picking up on the fact that daily ginger consumption helps soothe daily arthritis pain as well as other chronic aches and pains. Even brain inflammation is sometimes handled or alleviated with ginger. One mainstream medical report asserts that ginger was no better than ibuprofen or arthritic.
No better than ibuprofen for arthritic inflammation relief. But ibuprofen is in NSAID, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug with many harmful long-term side effects, affecting kidneys, liver, and intestines while damaging the immune system. With all the concern regarding increased nuclear fallout and radiation from Fukushima, it's good to know that ginger offers considerable radiation protection, but it needs to be consumed on a daily basis. How to use ginger is in the next section of this article. It makes sense to use natural, less expensive anti-inflammatory that is also an immune system enhancing tonic on a daily basis for chronic aches and pains. Since ginger extract have so many powerful mainstream medical applications as implied above, your daily or frequent use of ginger root will certainly provide considerable health benefits. Powdered ginger capsules are handy to have on hand, but either juicing or brewing as a tea from fresh ginger roots are the best way to use ginger. Make sure the ginger roots you purchase are crisp with smooth outer skins and avoid the most wrinkled roots. Avoid the moist wrinkled roots.
Right.
So a traditional method is to first skin the roots, then cut several long thin slices that can be placed in a pot of pure water. The more ginger slices, the better. Too strong is easily thinned down with added water. Too weak is almost useless as a tonic or a remedy. After bringing the pot to a boil, bring the heat down and let it simmer around for a half hour. The pot with water and ginger can remain intact overnight, but pour the rest into a glass and contain it to refrigerate. If the tea is strong enough, you can treat it like a concentrate. Pour some into a cup. Add hot water each time you have some. If the taste is slightly offensive, add some raw honey. If you have a slow-speed metastasticating juicer, you can juice a small, freshly peed piece of thick root as part of whatever juice you like to drink. If you make water kefir, you can add a tablespoon or two of this thick, heavy ginger liquid into it. The fermentation process for every pint of water kefir you brew. So that's one way to get
ginger. Yeah.
Use ginger. I guess it can really do a lot for you.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's very protective.
Especially in detoxing this.
Yeah, and as an anti-inflammatory, I'll have to remember that.
Yeah. And there's one other I wanted to get. Actually, several others. There's this one, and then there's one. Just one more. There's one we'll get to it tonight. I was thinking of using it as the last one. But solar flare could unleash nuclear holocaust across planet Earth, forcing hundreds of nuclear power plants into total meltdowns.
Remember that the key word is could.
Yeah.
It doesn't say that it will, but it could.
It says could, yeah. It says, forget about the 2012 Mayan calendar, Comet Elenin, or the Rapture. The real threat to human civilization is far more mundane, and it's right in front of our noses. If Fukushima has taught us anything, it's that just one runaway meltdown of fissionable nuclear material can have wide-ranging and potentially devastating consequences for life on Earth. To date, Fukushima has already released 168 times the total radiation released from the Hiroshima nuclear bomb detonated in 1945. The Fukushima catastrophe is now undeniably the worst nuclear disaster in the history of human civilization. But what if human civilization faced a far greater threat than a single tsunami destroying the nuclear power facility? What if a global tidal wave could destroy the power-generating capacities of all the world's power plants all at once? Such a scenario is not merely possible, but factually inevitable, and the global tidal wave threatening all the power in the nuclear power plants of the world isn't made of water, but solar emissions. The sun, you see, is acting up again. NASA recently warned that solar activity is surging, with a peak expected to happen in 2013, that would generate enormous radiation levels that sweep across planet Earth. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has even issued an urgent warning about solar flares due to strike in 2012 and 2013. IB Times wrote, with solar activity expecting to peak around 2013, the sun is entering a particularly active time and big flares like the recent one, will likely be common during the next few years. A major flare in the mid-19th century blocked the Nassau telegraph system, and some scientists believe that another such event is now overdue. The story goes on to explain, several federal government studies that this extreme solar activity and emissions may result in complete blackouts for years in some areas of the nation. Moreover, there may also be disruption of power supplies for years or even decades, as geomagnetic currents attracted by the storm could debilitate the transformers. Why does all this matter? To understand that, you have to understand how nuclear power plants function. Or, put another way, how is nuclear material prevented from going nuclear every single day across our planet? Every nuclear power plant operates in a near meltdown state.
Yeah,
isn't that interesting? This is kind of a really long article. Maybe you can help me read it.
Okay, we can read a little bit more. Let me read this part.
As
nuclear power plants are operated in near nuclear meltdown status, they operate at very high heat, relying on nuclear fission to boil water that produces steam to drive the turbines that generate electricity. Critically, the nuclear fuel is prevented from melting down through the steady circulation of coolants, which are pushed through the cooling system using very high-powered electric pumps. If you stop the electric pumps, which is what happened at Fukushima, the coolant stops flowing and the fuel rods go critical and then melt down. Yeah, and here it is. This is what happened at Fukushima, where the melted fuel rods dropped through the concrete floor of the containment vessels, unleashing enormous quantities of ionizing radiation into the surrounding environment. The full extent of the Fukushima contamination is not even known yet, as the facility is still emitting radiation. It's crucial to understand that nuclear coolant pumps are usually driven by power from the electrical grid. They are not generally driven by power locally from the nuclear power plant itself. Instead, they're connected to the grid. In other words, even though nuclear power plants are generating megawatts of electricity for the grid, they are also dependent on the grid to run their own coolant pumps. If the grid goes down, the coolant pumps go down, too, which is why they are quickly switched to emergency backup power, either generators or batteries. As we learned with Fukushima, the on-site batteries can only drive the coolant pumps for around 8 hours. After that, the nuclear facility is dependent on diesel generators, or sometimes propane, to run the pumps that circulate the coolant, which prevents the whole site from going Chernobyl. And yet, critically, this depends on something rather obvious, the delivery of diesel fuel to the site. If diesel cannot be delivered, the generators can't be fired up and the coolant can't be circulated. When you grasp the importance of this supply line dependency, you will understand why a single solar flare could unleash a nuclear holocaust across the planet. When the generators fail and the coolant pumps stop pumping, nuclear fuel rods begin to melt through the containment rods, unleashing ungodly amounts of life-destroying red radiation directly into the atmosphere. This is precisely why Japanese engineers worked so hard to reconnect the local power grid to the Fukushima facility after the tidal wave. They needed to bring power back to the generators to run the pumps that circulate the coolant. This effort failed, of course, which is why Fukushima became such a nuclear disaster and released countless becquerels of radiation into the environment with no end in sight. And yet, despite the destruction we've already seen with Fukushima, U.S. nuclear power plants are nowhere near being prepared to handle sustained power grid failures, as IB Times reports. Last month, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission said U.S. plants affected by a blackout should be able to cope without electricity for at least 8 hours and should have procedures to keep the reactor and spent fuel pool cool for 72 hours. Nuclear plants depend on standby batteries and backup diesel generators. Most standby power systems would continue to function after a severe solar storm, but supplying the standby power systems with adequate fuel when the main power grids are offline for years could become a very critical problem. If the spent fuel rods pools at the country's 104 nuclear power plants lose their connection to the power grid, the current regulations aren't sufficient to guarantee those pools won't boil over, exposing the hot zirconium-clad rods and sparking fires that would release deadly radiation.
And how the end of modern civilization will most likely occur. As any sufficiently informed scientist will readily admit, solar flares have the potential to blow out the transformers throughout the national power grid. That's because solar flares induce geomagnetic currents, powerful electromagnetic impulses, which overload the transformers and cause them to explode. You've probably witnessed this yourself during a lightning storm when lightning unleashes a powerful electronic magnetic pulse that causes a local transformer to explode.
Mm-hmm.
Well, solar flares do the same thing on a much larger scale, a global scale, in fact. The upshot of this situation is that suddenly, and without warning, the power grid infrastructure across nearly the entire planet could be destroyed. As a bonus, nearly all satellites will be fried, too, leaving GPS inoperable and causing millions of clueless drivers to become forever lost in their own neighborhoods because they never paid attention to the streets and always relied on GPS voice to tell them in 50 feet to turn right.
Communication satellites will be obliterated, too. This, of course, will halt nearly all news propaganda distribution across the planet, causing tens of thousands of people to instantly die out of the sheer fear of suddenly having to think for themselves. As another bonus, nearly all mobile phone service will be disrupted too, meaning all teenage text junkies of the world, for the first time in their lives, be forced to lay down their iPhones and interact with real people in the real world. But the kicker in all this is that the power grid will be destroyed nearly everywhere. What happens when there's no electricity? Imagine a world without electricity, even just for a week. Imagine New York City with no electricity, or Los Angeles, or San Paulo. Within 72 hours, most cities around the world will dissolve into total chaos, complete with looting, violent crime, and runaway fires. But that's not even the bad news. Even if all the major cities of the world burn to the ground for some other reason, humanity could still recover because it has the farmlands, the soil, the seeds, and the potential to recover, right? And yet the real crisis here stems from the realization that once there is no power grid, all of the nuclear power plants of the world suddenly go into emergency mode and are forced to rely on their on-site emergency power backups to circulate coolant and prevent nuclear meltdowns from occurring. And yet, as we've already established, these facilities typically have only a few hours of battery power available, followed by a few days' worth of diesel food to run their generators. Did I also mention that half of the people who work at a nuclear power facility have no idea what they're doing in the first place? Most of the veterans who really know the facilities inside and out have been forced into retirement due to reaching their lifetime limits of the on-the-job radiation exposure. So most of those workers at nuclear facilities right now are newbies who have no clue what they're doing.
And why refineries will not shut down, too. But this article goes on. But I suggest you go to naturalnews.com, check this one
and
out.
And you can get the real scoop on what could happen.
And,
doesn't say it will, but it said it could.
And I'd like to go on to, we're going to go
to our guest
here, so we've got to call him.
We'll give our guest a call, but what do you think about that, folks? I mean, that's really something to think about, that nuclear
We are so dependent. We are so dependent on
telephone, cell phone, electricity, computers, iPods, iPads. It's really, I don't know what, I'd be kind of lost without some of my conveniences.
Oh, sure. They're dialing up Larry right now.
Is that his cell phone?
Hey, Leo, how you doing?
Hey, Larry.
Hi, Larry. It's Lila, too.
Hi, Lila. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you doing?
We're doing very well. We're actually monitoring some primary results, and we've got some good news out of New Haven. So,
oh, what's happened down there?
Well, we have a slate of endorsed candidates for aldermen, all of whom won in the primaries today. And that's, you know, part of our plan to try to kind of take back the New Haven community from a mayor has been on the attack. And
How did DiStefano make out? Was there anybody running against him?
He had a three-way primary. I mean, all the prognostications were that he would, you know, win, but we did not take a position in that race. We kind of, you know, our folks in the down in the community put their resources into the alderman races, figuring that that's the best way to, you know, kind of fight back. So it's very exciting.
Oh, that's good. Well, congratulations on that.
Yeah.
And I know you'll probably be very active in helping those guys, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure, go on to win. That would be wonderful.
Go ahead.
I wanted to ask you, we haven't had a chance to ask you lately, is there any news on the Red Cross? Has anything changed there? I know that union had really worked hard to change things. Is there anything going on in that area?
There is. Something significant, actually. The federal judge ruled the Red Cross was guilty for the five charges that the National Labor Relations Board issued against them for unfair labor practices. So that is a tremendous vindication for us.
This ruling came
about 10 days ago.
Will they find, or what will happen?
What will happen is, obviously, we're going to be pushing for what the judge ordered, was that the Red Cross make our workers whole and make the changes, undo the negative changes they made to the contract. And what they did was they unilaterally changed health care insurance, pension, insurance for part-timers, disability coverage. They just unilaterally made those changes. Now, obviously, the Red Cross may appeal this decision. We'll see what happens, but I think it helps give us leverage to tell them that they've got to get to the table and finally start negotiating in good faith, and we'll see if that happens. I'll have a better sense of that when we next talk. We have a negotiation in early October, so we'll see how that session goes.
Those people have been so unfairly treated. I do hope that that ruling prevails and those people are made whole. And, of course, the safety of the public is taken into consideration.
Which is what, you know.
Sorry, go ahead, Larry.
No, Lila's absolutely right. I mean, this is, if people are on Facebook, actually, they shouldn't type in the search, keep blood drive safe. We have several of the unions. We went through the AFL-CIO, put together this Facebook page, and we have an online petition, and I would really urge your listeners and surfers to get on and sign the electronic petition and also learn more about what's going on in terms of the campaign to make sure that blood drives are as safe as possible, because I think the safety of blood drives is inextricably tied to the how the Red Cross treats its workers.
Yeah.
So, not to change the subject, but I was curious, what's your take on Malloy these days?
I don't know that it's radically. It's a good question. I don't know that it's radically different. You know, we just got through some very hard bargaining, obviously, that fortunately ended up with a ratification. But the fact remains is that he did drive certainly a hard bargain. He certainly seemed to put a great deal of pressure, monetarily and otherwise, on state employees, not as much pressure on the corporations, not as much pressure on the rich. But contained within the agreement that state employees ratified are hundreds of millions of dollars in savings that would come through making state government more efficient. And a primary way to do that is through labor management committees that would implement the cost savings ideas of frontline workers. We had a couple hundred of these come that were filtered through a joint labor management committee. These are, you know, so we are calling on the governor to get moving and start putting that stuff in place. And along with the cost savings ideas, there's got to be a commitment by the administration to reduce the excessive bureaucracy and management, and we're going to hold them to it.
Oh, good. Good. That's wonderful.
Turning to the national scene now, Larry, what do you think of Obama's job plan? Does that seem to make any sense to you?
You know, I'm not hesitating to be a wise guy. I'm hesitating because it's a complicated situation. And, you know, in his defense, he's dealing with some real, quite frankly, some real crackpots in Congress and otherwise who are resistant to doing anything that will benefit the struggling middle class. And lower middle class, working class people. So he's in a difficult position. I think he did the best he could with laying out a vision for creating jobs and getting the economy moving again. But he's got tremendous obstacles, and obviously he's going to have a far right wing opponent who's going to be demonizing everything that he has stood for. So I think he articulated a strong and clear vision. Whether he can achieve that vision is going to be entirely different. That's not because of any faults of his. That's because of what he's dealing with in Congress, and that's because, for whatever reason, the debate has shifted from creating jobs for working class people and strengthening their stake in the economy to this crazy debt ceiling and budget deficit reduction debate that has really been so that, you know, the jobs and middle class message has just been hijacked.
What did you think of James Hoffa's
loved it. Quote, you don't even have to finish your sentence.
Yeah, James.
His attack on the teabaggers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What did you think of that?
I was really. No, I don't. I think that it was necessary. I really applauded his willingness to do that. And look, he, you know, that took guts because there are many union members who belong to, I'm sure, who belong to the Tea Party or who share some of the beliefs. And I think he's really trying to confront head on the kind of the hypocrisy and the doublespeak that's going on, because really that. You know, so much of the Tea Party message, I think, has been co-opted by the powerful and by the corporations, and the Tea Parties are
kind absolutely
being
How does a union person reconcile being a Tea Party member? You know what I mean? How can anybody agree as a union?
I don't have an easy answer for you. I think that it is an interesting and troubling dynamic that we need to try to learn from and figure out as we head into the next election cycle, because clearly there are many workers who, I mean, working class, middle class people who share some, if not all, of the Tea Party philosophy, but it's very, you know, it's sort of contradictory to be espousing the Tea Party principles when the Tea Party is really this construct of people, of billionaires, like, you know, the billionaire Koch brothers, all the anti-government, anti-union, anti-worker forces that have coalesced to drive down people's living standards and to put more money in the hands of the elite few. So it is, you're right, it's a contradictory message, but it's been an effective one. There's no doubt.
But to be fair, though,
these guys up, and I don't understand how anybody with half a brain can actually get so psyched up over this thing.
To be fair, though, Leo, I think that the original idea of the Tea Party was hijacked and taken over by these rich corporatists. And I think a lot of the people who originally...
they're still, like, what they've done is they've pushed it on, I mean, and you still got these boneheads out there that are running
around. I don't think they really understand that that was that whole idea and that whole message.
Well, they
want to
do away. I mean, did you, what did you make of that? Have you watched any of the recent debates, Larry?
No, I haven't. And that's been, you know, quite frankly, I've been reading a tremendous amount about them, but I did not want to, I didn't care to watch any of them. I guess
I think you
I'm
would
not
have
quite ready.
I don't know if you could have enjoyed them. They were rather
frightening.
I found them quite frightening, actually, because, I mean, they were talking about doing away with Social Security.
Calling it a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah. Doing away with Medicare, doing away with Medicaid, doing away with FEMA, doing away with every major government program, okay? And people were applauding, you know?
Well, they were probably paid by the corporations to applaud.
But the most frightening thing was, is that, you know, Ron Paul, who I had a glimmer of hope for, all right, came out and said, when somebody asked him, well, why would if you took away Social Security, if you took away Medicare, if you took away all of these basic programs, what would happen to the people? All
right?
What would happen to them? And he said, now here's a doctor, right? He says, well, you know, what used to happen to them? He says, well, you have the church, you have charities, and people die.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, man, you know, right there, the guy is a doctor who has absolutely no freaking compassion. You know what I mean?
No, and it's frightening.
It blew me away. It totally blew me away.
That's the mentality.
And what blew me away more was that the audience cheered. Cheered.
Well, those
are all who could afford their own health insurance, right?
Right. And they cheered when Perry said Texas has executed, you know, 202 to upwards of 300 people.
It's disgraceful, that part.
So we're headed in a dangerous direction here where, you know, it's
extreme.
I almost feel like we're headed toward, you know, fascism of some sort.
I think we're already there, Larry.
I think we're already there. We're a corporate system. I mean, the whole Congress is bought off. They seem to pass so many laws that favor corporations. The corporation is now a person.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court, that's ridiculous.
Which is
that
just
was a horrible ruling.
That was one of the most alarming things. And, you know, we're stuck with the Supreme Court for quite a while.
Well, there's a movement to
amend
that decision.
Amend the Constitution to kill that decision, and it's sponsored actually by the Green Party, and the Green Party was the guy who ran. About 8 years ago, I believe.
For Congress.
For president.
I thought he ran for Chris Murphy's seat.
He was the presidential
nominee
from the
Green Party. It wasn't in the last cycle. It must have been the cycle before.
They're sponsoring. They're trying to sponsor an amendment, constitutional amendment, right, to oppose that ruling. In fact, Ralph Nader even came out with he proposed the impeachment of the Supreme Court. Okay.
Based on members of
the Supreme Court, he stated that based on that decision. Proved them to be unqualified for the position, and not only incompetent, but corrupt. All right, and he went on and on and on in a great article regarding that.
But you don't see much of that on the mainstream media, do you?
So at least the Green Party
not at all.
Has been a move as trying to push push for a constitutional amendment.
But if you go to their site, the Green Party, you probably see that on their site, I would guess.
Probably somewhere down there.
That's an institutional majority in that Supreme Court. You know, Alito and Roberts, Scalia, Thomas, they're not going anywhere. And, they're a bad group of guys. It's quite simple. And Roberts actually is the ultimate corporatist. That's one reason Bush nominated him in the first place. So we're going to be living with the consequences of the Supreme Court, I fear, for quite a while.
Yeah, unless something happens, and God forbid anything of that magnitude could ever happen, it's always worth hoping for. Maybe everybody has a heart attack up there at the same time, within the same year.
Well, you don't want to wish people ill, but boy.
Remember Pat Robertson?
Yeah.
When he said to pray for the death of the Supreme Court?
I remember that. Do you remember that, Larry?
I don't.
Oh yeah, yeah.
He didn't like some of the rulings, and he wanted all of his
liberal court and so on. And he said, "Please pray for a nuclear rain or some major, this is on his, he said this on his own show, on the 700 of their missionaries.
But anyway. We're coming up to, we're thinking about the next presidential election. How is AFSCME getting ready for that?
We have a lot of work to do, I will say that much. But I think really what we're trying to do is continue all of the projects like we have and efforts that we have in places like New Haven and other cities and towns. It's we want to continue our campaign for the middle class. I think that the best way we can prepare for the elections is to make sure that we remind our members about the stakes. The economy, we all understand the economy has not improved as much as we'd like. But you guys just articulated a very dangerous vision that could very well prevail if people are indifferent or fed up with the political process. And so I think that the mobilization that we'll do is really going to be a continuation of reminding and drilling down into the communities that we're going to move forward. Good jobs with decent pay and benefits and a voice on the job is the way to do it. And we've got to be very, very cautious but firm in dealing with and deciding what candidates merit an endorsement, based on their willingness to go to the mat for workers. Now more than ever, we need that. That may reduce the list, but the fact of the matter is that's where we're headed.
Well, was it Larry Summers that wrote that article just recently that we read?
Yeah.
Larry Summers just wrote an article on supporting Obama's plan to fix infrastructure and hire construction workers. Now, he sees it more, he thinks it should be more of a 10-year plan, and the reason he puts that forward is that he feels that interest rates are either at 0% or 2%, and this is the time to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's absolutely right. I think we should build up our falling infrastructure so that we can stimulate business.
We do, and the problem is the medium and the message. The right wing is, and the corporations are really hijacking so much of the agenda for their own narrow purposes that taking a long view is not something that tends to play well in this country anymore.
No.
Yet that's what we have to do. And I was listening to an interview with Jared Bernstein, who used to be at the Economic Policy Institute, and now he's an economic consultant. He has a very informative website, and he also served for Joe Biden for the vice president for a while. So Jared made an excellent point that if to make Obama's plan more realistic and achievable, we have 100,000 plus schools, public schools across the country in need of infrastructure repair and environmental remediation and other needs. So, you know, the shovel-ready projects aren't that plentiful right now, or that, I should say, the shovel-ready projects aren't quite that easy to identify and pull off right now. But the schools are, as you know, Lila, schools are there. We have those 200,000-plus schools that Bernstein talked about are schools that are as much as 40 years old. And they're crumbling, and they need repair. And this would be a really great way to put people to work immediately. You don't have to necessarily build new schools, but you do have to get in there and repair some of these schools. So that's one way to go about stimulating the economy and tying it directly to a better education for our kids. So, you know.
Wouldn't
they,
I think that's a great idea.
What have the Republicans stated they must cut in order to grant these new jobs? What areas?
They want to cut Social Security, Medicare. They want to do a whole bunch of things that will be dangerous to the average middle class person. And I don't even believe that they want to see this jobs thing go through. I really don't.
Don't think so.
No. I think what they want to do. I just read an article, for example, that one thing that they, especially the far-right Republicans, would cut would be to privatize the Postal Service and put 500,000-plus middle-class workers probably out of work by privatizing it. I mean, they have a whole bunch of crazy schemes to achieve their vision, and it's, as I say, it's very frightening. But I think, you know, at root, they certainly don't want to see this president succeed, and they don't want to see a vigorous middle class in this country.
Well,
I'm sure they have just the right corporation to take over the Postal Service.
The Postal Service is a private corporation. It is a private.
It's like one of those quasi-private.
You're talking about employees who are public employees who are accountable.
They went to Congress and asked for permission to be able to cut 120,000 jobs, I think it was.
I think so.
And 3,700 post office outlets.
Right.
It was unbelievable.
Just mentioned they want to butcher a whole bunch of agencies, including the National Labor Relations Board, that respond to the needs and the interests and the concerns of everyday Americans. So it's frightening stuff, and that's why I applaud the president for the vision and the plan that he laid out. Our union certainly wants to see it put into play, but there are very sinister forces at work here to torpedo this whole thing, so we'll have to see if it happens.
What's your impression of them streamlining some of these facilities,
Post office.
I mean, you know, to me, to have two post offices here in
no,
this
we have
town,
more than that.
Well, yeah, what do we got? Well, just in an 8-mile radius.
No, we have three.
Not in Salisbury.
Yes, we have Salisbury, Lakeville, and Taconic.
And Taconic. Then you got one in East Canaan. Then you got one in Canaan. Then you got one in within eight or ten miles, you've got five or six post offices.
No, the problem is that the volume of mail is down considerably with the internet and emailing and iPodding and messaging. So they do have to do something to respond to that, I think. But it's an overwhelming task, I think.
Don't you think they have to streamline somewhat to stay afloat, or do you think we should just subsidize them? Continue to subsidize as much as we can.
What do you think about that, Larry?
Say that again.
Well, I said with the volume of mail declining, I think we have to do some kind of streamlining with the post office, but how they go about it, I don't know.
Yeah, look, it's a hard issue to answer. You know, technology has certainly changed, from faxing way back when people still faxed to, like you said, the iPodding and everything else that's going on. But, again, you're talking about what is essentially hospital is truly a public entity, and it's accountable. You know, you can send that you can send that letter for the same 44 cents to California or New York. You know, the cost hasn't gone up that much. I think it's a wonderful thing, and whatever happens, I'm just simply saying that that's the kind of stuff that the Republicans want to get their hands on and butcher. And if it was truly privatized, which is to say, you know, no, which is to say, totally in private hands, no public employees, no union,
yeah, I don't think that's right.
You're going to see the costs skyrocket. I just promise
sure.
you that. Yeah.
Well, they can't wait to get their hands on anything that they see that can make some particular person a lot of money. I'm sure
yep.
they have it all waiting. Somebody's going to mm-hmm. want it, and they're going to try to get it.
Well, they mm-hmm. stole trillions from the Treasury already, just the bankers did. So, hey, what
right.
did you think? Did you see Bank of America is ready to lay off 30,000 workers?
That's unbelievable.
Did you see that?
It's just despicable. You know,
isn't it?
Just awful. Unbelievable. Well, you know it'll be the employees that can't afford to be laid off.
Right. Bank of America in Connecticut has actually a very high percentage of people who are on, those kids are on Husky, who don't have health care themselves, the employees. So, you know, they're taking the handouts. They can't get enough of a slop at the trough with taxpayers' money, but they can't treat their employees very well.
That's disgraceful. Did you know that
I don't know if I sent you this article or not, but J.P. Morgan is handling the food stamp distribution for this country.
Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that, but that doesn't surprise me.
J.P. Morgan, financial mm-hmm. services, are the people that are collecting or distributing, I should say, the food stamps for the United States.
One of the things that businesses petitioning the government. Yum Foods, who owns Taco Bell Pizza Hut and some other things, they want Americans who are on food stamps to be able to purchase their food.
Yeah, well, look, we represent the Department of Social Services eligibility workers in Connecticut who have been fighting this kind of state-level privatization from Roland. Maximus was going to do child care eligibility, and it's crazy, scary stuff. You've got private companies that are highly inefficient that are being brought in to for political favors and getting this business, and they have no business being in social services, but it's something to pad their profit margins with.
I feel like we're in this
speech. Yeah, we are.
We're
in a dangerous place. We're in a dangerous
place,
Ada. But we also can fight back.
Yeah, well, you guys are trying your best. There's no question about that. I hope you got some well deserved rest after the go round.
Definitely, and as I say, the news is wonderful from New Haven. So we achieved something very good and very real here, and you know, we'll just try to make it spread. We'll try to make it spread.
That would be wonderful, Larry.
I look forward to talking to you guys soon.
Thanks so much for being on, Larry.
Good. Thanks for having me. I have to actually get a press release out on New Haven, so I'm going to head back to the computer. Thank you.
Good night, Larry.
Good night.
Thanks
Take
so
care.
Much.
Good night, guys.
Good night. That was Larry Dorman from Council for Public Affairs Coordinator in out of New Britain talking about union positions and at least we have some positive things to say about New Haven. But there are some rough times ahead. I mean, it's been tough.
Yeah.
It seems like everything is being attacked.
So we got Woody coming up there on the phone. And so hang on one second. Here we go.
step into the ring with Woody.
Thank you, Lila. Your previous guest sound an awful lot like Brian Cashman. His voice sounded like Brian Cashman, the GM of the Yankees.
Oh, really? That was Larry Dorman from AFSCME, Union for, Public Affairs Coordinator from New Britain.
His voice sounded a lot like Brian Cashman. Kind of funny. Okay. Good evening, sportsmen. Watch your heads on the ropes as you step into the ring with Woody. Tonight's topics, NBA lockout, point shaving, my stone cold locks of the week, along with last week's picks, and of course, baseball. Let's get down to it. The NBA and its locked out players resumed the collective bargaining negotiations today in New York. The league's Labor Relations Committee and the National Basketball Players Association Executive Committee will join the talks and see if the sides can draw closer to an ending the 74-day lockout. Training camps are scheduled to open in early October. Also, the NBA fined Charlotte Bobcats owner Michael Jordan an undisclosed amount for unauthorized comments made to an Australian newspaper about the lockout. Last I checked, Jordan sleeps on a pile of money, which is on top of another pile of money. So no fine will probably do anything more than just be like a gnat biting him on the ass. The talks didn't go well today, and as I've said many times before, I believe the NBA is going to lose its season. More on that, obviously, as the story develops, but it didn't look good today. And as I said, I don't think the NBA is going to have a season. Okay, now, a lot of times when you go to the casino, your thought is always, okay, the casino never cheats me. That's why it's all right to go to the casino rather than go to some illegal gambling parlor, which some people may participate in. Well, that is not always the case. Bettors still upset over how the Las Vegas sportsbook handled the ending of Saturday's Utah-Southern California game are continuing to complain to Nevada gambling regulators. Jerry Markling, enforcement chief of the Nevada Gaming Control Board, told the Associated Press that regulators had been taking calls and were working with casinos to try to resolve any disputes from the game, which saw the final score change from 17-14 to 23-14 after the Pacific 12 officials allowed USC's last-second touchdown that had originally been negated by officials on the field because of an excessive celebration penalty. The point spread for the game was roughly, 8.5. So that was the difference between covering and not covering. At least one sportsbook, meanwhile, is taking the corrected score of 23-14 and isn't looking back. When they changed the official score, 23-14, in the USC-Utah game, we regraded all the wagers as this was the official score of the game by the NCAA, Bodog's sportsbook manager Richard Gardner said. This does occur now and again in various sports such as boxing or MMA, but the rules in those particular sports are the ringside decision is final for wagering purposes. In football, the scores change on game day. That is what we go with according to our sports-specific rules. Obviously, some casinos are trying to weasel out of paying some of their wagers. Obviously, a lot of the money was, with the spread. So if they didn't cover, well, then, the casino didn't want to pay. So, it's just typical, the casino. There's been instances where someone's hit on a slot machine for millions of dollars, and it was just in the paper probably about 2 months ago, and the casino said it was an aberration and they weren't going to pay the poor guy the $32 million. Of course, I guess, the machine was working fine when it was taking the guy's money, but when he became a winner, well, that's when the machine obviously was malfunctioning. So just goes to show that maybe, even gambling with a casino sometimes can be kind of shiesty. So, all right. My Stone Cold picks last week, I was 3-0. Quite a way to start the week out. The Packers covered in what was a high-scoring game. Very interesting game. Not much defense was played. New Orleans certainly could have won the game. Some bad play calling down at the end there really could have changed the outcome of the game, but what are you going to do? My Bears handled their business at home against Atlanta. Atlanta had been the a sleeper Super Bowl pick by many, I might add, and the Bears really handled them. Physically, got a lot of turnovers. Brian Urlacher got himself a touchdown, and the Bears look good. And when Urlacher's healthy, things are looking good. I mean, it's early. We'll see, but I certainly like the outcome of the game. And on Monday night, I was probably one of three people in the country that picked the Raiders over Denver in Denver. Raiders getting three, mind you, and the Raiders won without the points, which is nice to see that they won on the field. So I went 3-0 for my Stone Cold Locks for the start of the season. Gotta like that. Let's get down to this week's picks. I'm going to go out on a limb here. I take a team I haven't taken in quite some time. I usually bet against them, but I will take them this week. I have the Lions at home giving 7.5 to the Chiefs. That's the Lions at home giving 7.5 to the Chiefs. I have the Steelers at home after the drubbing they received by Baltimore last week. They got embarrassed in Baltimore. But I like the Steelers. I think that game was a bit of an aberration. You know, it was a rivalry game, and sometimes one team really gets at it at the other team, especially on their home field. So I think the Steelers are going to turn around, and I think they're really going to bite the Seahawks in the ass. Big spread. It opened at 13.5. It's up to 14.5. I'm going to take the Steelers regardless of the points. We have the Texans in Miami. Texans much improved. They handed it to Indianapolis. I picked the Texans over Indianapolis on not on my Stone Cold Locks, but on another thing that I do. And I like the Texans. I picked them to win this division. They're much improved. The Dolphins, you know, are in a bit of array. They got smashed by New England last night. And I think the Texans are going to handle them as well. So I like the Texans. I'm not sure what the spread's going to be. The Texans will be getting some points because they're in Miami. So I have the Lions -7.5, Steelers -14.5, and the Texans plus whatever it is they're getting. Okay, interesting stuff going on in tennis. I'm not sure if anyone watches tennis anymore. I don't really watch it. Usually I hear about this stuff after the fact. But Serena Williams was fined $2,000 Monday by the U.S. Open for berating the chair umpire during the final. Tournament referee Brian Early issued the fine a day after Williams was cited by chair umpire Eva Adereke for a code violation for verbal abuse during a 6-2, 6-3 loss to Sam Stauskas in the Women's Singles Championship in New York. Now, if people aren't aware of what happened, here's what went down. Serena hit what looked like to be a winning shot, and I guess she kind of let out a grunt before the other player got a chance to strike the ball. That is it's like a verbal obstruction or something. And the chair ref took the point away from her. To me, that's a little extreme. They do allow you to play the point over. I personally can't stand Serena Williams, but in this instance, I don't know. I guess her track record kind of screwed her, but boy, she's won an awful lot of big matches and stuff like that. And for a player of her caliber, you know, bad track record or not, I really think, you know, she's won a lot of Grand Slams. I think that you got to give her the benefit of the doubt and, you know, just replay the point. But that's not what happened. They took the point from her, and she ended up nosediving for the rest of the match. And as you can see, you know, if the USTA had been really upset with her, you know, they would have fined her quite a bit more than $2,000. I'm sure she's got that $2,000 in her sock somewhere, so she's not too worried about that. But I just thought that was kind of interesting. Speaking of interesting, I watched a number of games over the weekend and saw some interesting stuff. I thought it was real nice to see Cam Newton, my Auburn quarterback there. He got into he's a starter. He threw for 422 yards and two touchdowns, and that was great. He looked really really impressive in his NFL debut. Sure, the Panthers did lose 28-21 to the Cards, but the kid looked good. The Giants seem to be in a bit of disarray. They certainly are banged up. You know, people are kind of starting to panic a little bit already. My personal opinion is that Eli Manning stinks and that they got lucky winning that Super Bowl. I mean, I just don't think Eli Manning's that good of a quarterback. And, you know, I think I'd have a lot of people that would agree with me, especially a lot of Giants fans. The Jets won a very typical Jet game. They're losing by a touchdown. Things are looking bad. Oh, next thing you know, they block a punt, and guy runs in for a touchdown, game tied. And then Tony Romo does a Tony Romo move and throws a ball just right into Revis's hands. I have no idea who Romo was throwing that ball to. I mean, Dez Bryant must have been have to have made like another cut or something or whatever. I just don't know what he's expecting his receiver Dez Bryant to do in that instance. It was just a horrendous throw, and obviously the Jets took advantage of that, and they kicked a real long 48-yard field goal, and that was the end of the game. But that's how the Jets win, by the skin of their teeth a lot of times. Rex Ryan does an awful lot of talking, as always. You know, he beat his brother, who was the defensive coordinator for the Cowboys, so Rex has bragging rights, even though, you know, the Jets didn't really play, you know, their play doesn't deserve, they shouldn't be bragging for the way that they played. But they did win. Well, I guess we'll give them the benefit of the doubt. I tell you, a team that looks vastly improved is the Buffalo Bills. They look very much improved. They went into Kansas City, and they smoked Kansas City. Kansas City hasn't been beaten like that at home, I believe, since sometime in the 1960s. So, you know, all you long-time suffering Buffalo Bills fans, I think you may have turned the corner a bit. You might have a little bit of a season to look forward to. So that's a good thing. So you got to like that. Let's move on to a little bit of baseball. All kinds of interesting stuff going on in baseball. The Red Sox are right in the middle of a serious, serious nosedive. For some reason, they've actually turned the playoffs into a little bit of the division into a little bit of a race here. They were sitting a few games above the Yankees until that series where the Yankees went up there and took 2 out of 3, and since then, they have just gone into the crapper. You know, their lead over the Rays right now is about 3.5 games. You know, sure, they're in a better position, but I tell you what, the Rays are going into Boston on Thursday for a 4-game set. You know, Josh Beckett has an injured ankle. Kevin Youkilis has what has been termed like a body hernia, I guess. It's no specific spot. It's called a sports hernia, just from getting banged up. You know, and the guy that's replaced him, he's batting like 168. Jed Lowry, he stinks. The Red Sox really seem to be banged up right now. Their pitching has just been absolutely horrendous. The last time through the rotation, none of their guys went more than 5 innings, and they've just been getting smashed. And, you know, I think, you know, for Tampa Bay to make a run of it, you know, they obviously have to go up here and come up here and win 3 out of 4. I think it's a good chance that they can do it. But, you know, it's tough to win 3 out of 4 in Boston, I'll tell you that right now. But Boston's not playing that great. They're kind of struggling. Hey, you never know. You know, kick a man when he's down. The Red Sox are down. Now's the chance. If you're the Rays, you got to take advantage of it. When they're down, you got to put that boot right on the neck and take care of business. So we'll see if the Tampa Bay guys got the killer instinct, you know, if they can perform here in the clutch. We'll certainly find out. Interesting thing going on in Chicago. The White Sox have certainly stunk all year, and the animated manager, Ozzie Guillen, he's been asking for a contract extension, which I find absolutely insulting. Last year, he flirted with going to the Florida Marlins, but he's been under contract until 2012. The White Sox have shown no public interest in giving him an extension, and that might prompt Guillen to reconsider the Marlins and allow Tony La Russa, the St. Louis Cardinals manager, to return to the White Sox, a team he once managed from 1979 to 1986. Two high-ranking White Sox officials said La Russa is their top choice to replace Guillen. Should he leave, the officials had not publicly discussed La Russa's availability because he is under contract. If Guillen leaves, he could be through a trade. The Seattle Mariners dealt manager Lou Piniella to the Tampa Bay Rays in 2002 for outfielder Randy Winn. White Sox chairman Jerry Reinsdorf said this year that the Marlins expressed interest in Guillen last winter, but before Reinsdorf would allow Florida to interview the manager, he wanted compensation to be determined, and then the talks broke off. The Marlins approached us about wanting to talk to Ozzy. He said, I love Ozzy, but if Ozzy didn't want to be here, I would consider letting him out of his contract, but not for nothing. La Russa, on a one-year deal, says he'll address his future after the season. So that's quite an interesting thing going on in Chicago. I think he has a lot of balls asking for a contract extension. I mean, they stink. They're 73-72. Detroit is, you know, they're 10.5 games back at Detroit. Detroit has ran away with that division. I don't know how, but, boy, they certainly have ran away with the division. Detroit has been very tough at home. They're 45-29 at home. They got a, you know, that's a pretty tough record right there. And 39-33 away, so they're, you know, very tough. A guy that I've covered many times, and it's always a pleasure, Manny Ramirez. Manny being Manny. Manny Ramirez's career spiraled down quite quickly this year, and his personal life seems to be heading in the same direction. Manny Ramirez's wife apparently called Florida police on Monday night to have him arrested on charges of domestic violence. Unnamed witnesses are saying that Ramirez was handcuffed and taken away in a police car after being involved in an altercation with his wife, Juliana. Ramirez, who hit 555 home runs in a 19-year career, spent mostly with the Cleveland Indians and the Boston Red Sox, began this past season with the Tampa Bay Rays and batted .059 in five games before retiring after being informed he had failed a Major League Baseball administered drug test. It was the second time Ramirez, 39, had violated baseball's performance-enhancing substance abuse policy. He served a 50-game suspension for the first violation in 09 and was facing a 100-game banishment. Known for his run-producing prowess and many goofy antics both on and off the field, Ramirez built a Hall of Fame resume with a 312 career average, 1,831 RBIs, plus the MVP award from the 2004 World Series with the Red Sox. However, his Coopertown worthiness has been questioned in light of his performance-enhancing drug-related suspensions. You know, Manny's done some crazy stuff over time. He got into it with some older guy employed by the Red Sox over some tickets for some friends. He, like, punched out this old traveling secretary. That's what it was with the Red Sox. I mean, he's just been a real, real whack job. And I think he was juicing too much and it probably got to his head a little bit. But he's always just been kind of wacky. And, you know, now he's been cuffed for smacking his old lady around. Not really too surprising. He's never been really that good of a guy. So no surprise there. Yankees are healing up. You know, a lot of guys have been banged up and a lot of guys are coming back into play. You got to like the looks of the Yankees. But I tell you, right now, I believe the strongest team in the American League is really starting to look like Detroit. They're really looking very tough with Verlander at the top of the rotation. But and the Red Sox are looking very vulnerable right now. I mean, you know, it's going to be interesting, you know. But this is why you play the games. Baseball is always fun. And, you know, and in the end, we all know it comes down to pitching. So we'll just have to see how everything pans out. But it's a great time of year to be a sports fan. You know, football is up and going. Baseball is coming down to the wire. I mean, it's a really fun time to be a sports fan. So let's all just kick back and enjoy it while we have it. That's it for this week. Shout out to all my woodheads out there, Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy, the lovely Sherry up in Maine, and Linda. That's it for this week. Hopefully we get a little bit of an Indian summer. Try and enjoy it while it lasts. Talk to you all next week.
Great. Thank Woody for his...
We appreciate his comments every night, every week.
Yeah.
And...
forward to his comments next week. And we just have a few minutes left.
We got about 9 minutes left, but I wanted to play this specifically this video.
And you'd be able to see audio part of it.
Yeah, and it's. I hate this. Okay, I had it all set up here for us, but hang on, here it is. Dr. Mercola discusses the FDA.
Well, this should be interesting.
It's a little long, but it's going to run. We're going to run out of time on it, but
let's listen to this.
Play it into the end. It's about 14 minutes long.
Okay, go right ahead.
If we don't come back in before the end of this, we'll just say goodnight now and hope you enjoy this. This is Dr. Mercola discussing the ban on natural supplements with the FDA.
Well, this is Dr. Mercola, and if you live in the United States and if you value your health freedom, this is going to be one of the most important videos you've watched in a long time. I would encourage you to share it with your family and friends. It involves the FDA. Now, the FDA's self-described mission is to protect and to promote the public health. Now, the reality is that the FDA is an agency that protects major industries and is tragically causing death and disease within this country and across the world. Now, the practice of corporate favoritism is disguised as a genuine concern for public safety. It's been going on.
Sorry, folks. Sorry, people.
Decades, and I've detailed many reports of corruption, conflicts of interest, and even convictions of fraud, bribery, and charges that have been exposed in plaguing this federal agency for years.
This one, to me, there's two that we want to I love this one tonight. Hang on a second. This one knocked me out. The hypocrisy of our government, of the Obama administration, surpasses the hypocrisy of George W. Bush.
You wouldn't even think that would be possible.
I never thought it would.
U.S. demands Egypt crack down on protesters.
Yeah. Egyptian junta vows harsh measures against dissent.
So you're not allowed to have any dissent in Egypt?
Not now. Not after Mubarak. There's only one dissenting voice, you know, and they took over the government, and now nobody else can do that.
Nobody else can have any dissent.
Underscoring just how thin their commitment to the Arab Spring protest movement actually is, the Obama administration is loudly demanding that the Egyptian military junta launch a crackdown on dissent to meet its obligations under the Vienna Convention. They warn the junta of consequences if they didn't crush the protests around the Israeli embassy.
The call was quickly praised by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who said he was confident the U.S. used all the means and influence at its disposal to press Egypt to take action against the protesters. On Friday, Egyptian protesters sacked the Israeli embassy, breaching an external barricade and swarming into the building, tossing Hebrew language paperwork into the streets. No embassy officials were hurt in the attack, but some 450 Egyptians were wounded by security forces. Egypt's junta predictably has announced that it'll be launching a new crackdown on all its public protests, adding it'll take harsh measures against anyone who aims to damage Egypt's image. They also vowed to use all articles of Hosni Mubarak's emergency law, which for decades has been used to silence any and all dissent, which was the center of the first protest movement earlier this year. The U.S. government wasn't keen on the first protest movement, which ousted Mubarak, but eventually came to publicly endorse it. It seems the protests against the interim junta and the demands to finally set a date for elections have reset the administration's position to its default, crush all dissent.
So here we go, folks. The great hypocrite Obama, you know. And, you know, because they attacked the Israeli embassy after the Israelis killed 8 Egyptians, the Egyptians said, fuck you, you know, and they went after them and kicked them the hell out. And if that would have been any other embassy, you know, forget about it. But because it was the Israeli embassy, no, crush all dissent.
You're not allowed to protest or have dissent.
The greatest hypocrites in the world are the United States and I don't know. The United States has got to be, because nobody cares about Israel. Nobody would give a shit about Israel if it wasn't for the United States.
And Britain.
And, well, Britain's a piece of crap country. Nobody cares about them anymore. They're a dead country. You know, all they're doing is they're a parasitic nation. They're parasitic on everybody. You know, just like the Israelis. You know, but essentially they're parasitic off us. You know,
mm-hmm.
So it's like, who needs them? But anyway, we're now at the end
right
of our
night. End of our show.
And might as well finish on a nasty note. But I swear to God, I can't stand these people. I can't stand this government, the way that the hypocrisy of this, our leaders, just beyond the pale, I'll tell you. So anyway.
But thanks for being with us, and we want to thank Larry Dorman from the AFSCME Union for being our guest tonight, and we thank Woody for his segment in the ring, and join us tomorrow night.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, folks.